We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics. Joining me today is legendary Rick Rule, investor, speculator, and founder and CEO of Rule Investment Media. Rick, thanks so much for joining me again today.
Tom, thank you. I always enjoy these interviews, so thank you for having me back.
Of course. Me too. And we're going to have a little bit of a different interview today. I subbed out my work and research for today, and I submitted questions from listeners. So we're going to cover a bunch of questions, and I think really we're going to cover, you know, quite the gamut of, you know, different topics. So I hope you're ready for it today.
I absolutely am. I've come to really enjoy this format. You may know I do Q&A in my own network, the Rule Classroom, and I did Q&A yesterday across Canada on BNN. It's interesting if you source the interest of thousands of people rather than the interest of just two, you and I. Yep. So I congratulate you on democratizing the process.
Well, you know, we got a lot of actually excellent questions, and we got some that were, you know, not so serious, but considering this is more of an educational channel, I think we should focus on the more serious ones. But I would like to start with one that's, you know, a little bit lighthearted. Mike Maloney asked you where you bought the almond toffee stuff that you mailed him.
There is a wonderful family-owned candy producer in Grand Junction, Colorado, called Enstrom's. Enstrom's was the gift of choice among the Denver oil and gas community in the early 70s when I lived there. And I have been giving Enstrom's candy ever since, much to the delight of people who do business with me. So I forget the spelling, but Enstrom, E-N-S-T-R-O-M, I think in Grand Junction, Colorado. It is, from my point of view, the finest broadly available candy on the planet.
Well, that must be some good stuff to, you know, keep going back and get the attention of Mike Maloney.
I should note that it's only shippable to American addresses, as far as I know. So for your audience outside the United States, in Mike's case, including Puerto Rico, it isn't broadly available.
Well, there are ways around that, you know, drop shipping things. So if people really want it, I'm sure they can get their hands on it.
Great.
So, Rick, I'd like to move on to, you know, something that we've been kind of touching on and getting different people's perspectives on. And I think yours would be, you know, extra interesting, considering that you've been in this space for so long. So at what point are the juniors going to attract capital? And why is there such a disconnect between the physical metal and the miners? And what will it take for the two to mean revert?
Generally, the progress of a bull market goes as follows. The commodity begins to move first. Then the biggest and finest and most broadly held participants, the majors, the high quality majors, move next. Then the rest of the majors and the mid caps move. Then the junior producers move. And then the penny dreadfuls, the explorers move. We saw in the mini market, the false bull market of 2019, 2020, 2021, something I'd never seen before, which was, I suspect, as a consequence of too much money in the system and the popularity of social media, we saw the penny dreadfuls move before the seniors moved and before the commodities moved. I'd never seen that before. And it turned out to have been a false bull market. But I would expect that the normal chain of events follows. I would expect that, as an example, as we've seen in the uranium market, the commodity moved. Then you had solid moves in things, particularly like Cameco, $8 to $44. then you had a follow through on the higher quality juniors, the next gens of the world, the Denisons of the world. And now you're seeing a broad spread response among the junior uraniums. I suspect that you'll see that in the precious metals market. I suspect if you see a pull through or a follow through in the gold price, that you will see strength in the Barricks, in the Newmonts and the Agnico Eagles of the world. I expect then that the bull market will spread to the second tier seniors and also to the single stage development companies. One of the reasons that you'll see this is if they don't go up in price, they'll be taken over by guys who whose prices do increase. Cost of capital is a durable, sustaining advantage. Your listeners would be well advised to think of a bull market as a circus master's whip. The front of the whip is the highest quality names. They move first. But the lower quality names, which move last, move further. And I think that's what you're going to see in the course of things. Now, as to the reason for the disconnect between metals prices and metals equities prices, I think there's two things. There's a normal lag, which we're going to see. But the second thing is, I really believe that the mining industry discredited itself in the decade 2000 to 2010. During that decade, the gold price, as an example, moved from $250 an ounce to $850 an ounce. And the free cash flow per share in the XAU fell. It took real skill to translate a sevenfold increase in the price of the commodity that you produce into a reduction in free cash flow per share. So the perception came among at least the institutional investment community that the people in the mining industry could screw up any opportunity. I think that's important to note. With regards to the juniors, it's also important to note. And by the way, this isn't meant to be a broad-based criticism of resource investors, just a statement of fact. If you look at the length and breadth of the juniors, probably only 10% of them are really viable. And I would suggest to you that the juniors are still overfunded because too much money goes to spend to supporting G&A among the lame, the halt, and the blind. When people talk about the fact that capital hasn't been available to juniors, I retort that I've only been able to do 6 private placements in the last 12 months because the terms have been insufficient to attract the capital. Companies that don't deserve to raise capital have had a hard time raising capital, which is not a bad thing. But companies that do deserve to raise capital have been able to raise lots and lots and lots of capital. So much capital that even in the placements that I've been able to participate in all 6 of them, I've been cut back. So I would argue that capital isn't scarce. High quality opportunity is scarce.
I think that's a perfect way to put it, Rick. And I like the analogy of the circus master's whip. It's, I think, just spot on.
Thank you.
So as we're on the subject of juniors, can you explain in a simple way convertible bond sale?
Convertible bonds and preferreds, I guess. We probably need to use both of them. They're in the capital stack. They are a way for investors to participate in a speculative venture in a less speculative way, not a non-speculative way, but a less speculative way. It gives you a senior call on the assets in liquidation, and it gives you a guaranteed return, at least guaranteed relative to all of the other shareholders. Remember, just because somebody promised you to pay in a convertible preferred or a convertible debenture, if they go broke, you ain't going to get paid. But you are going to come out ahead of other shareholders. So these are instruments that are on the balance sheet, at least senior to the interests of the common shareholders. They commonly include an interim cash payment, a dividend, which can either be cash or additional shares. This is useful because if you're like me, usually early in a resource move, you overcome the net present value calculation, the opportunity cost, by getting a coupon while you wait. The penalty that the issuer charges the investor is that the conversion to common equity usually occurs at above market price. So the first part of the capital gain, which the common shareholder commandeers as a consequence of his or her willingness to take more risk and not get a coupon, is the fact that the first part of the capital gain accrues to the common shareholder rather than to the preferred shareholder or the convertible preferred shareholder. From my own point of view, in juniors, there is so much upside when you win that giving up some of the upside in return for eliminating most of the downside is a really good deal. Let's say, as an example, that a company is selling on market for $1 a share. And let's say that they think the value within the company is such that it's too dilutive to existing shareholders to sell common shares for $1. So they sell me a convertible preferred at $1.50. I consign the first part of the capital gain achieved with the money that I contributed to the company to the existing common shareholders. In return, I get convertibility at $1.50. I get a preference if the company goes into bankruptcy. That is, the first part of the proceeds of the sale go to me, not to the common shareholders. And I get a 6 or 7% coupon, meaning that my cost of capital, if there's a 2-year hiatus before wonderful things happen, gets taken care of by the coupon. From my point of view, if I've bought this dollar stock because I think it's going to go to 4 or 5, the fact that I gave up the first 50 cents, in return for which I got 7 cents a year or 8 cents a year for 2 or 3 years, and I got priority position, is often worth my while. In a circumstance where there's all kinds of upside, if you are right, trading off a bit of that upside in return for trading off most of your downside ends up being a pretty good equation.
And it also seems a good way to kind of mitigate some of that risk as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely, positively is way to mitigate the risk. There are also various ways that people like me participate in non-convertible, meaning, as an example, a subordinated debenture or senior secured project financing, where we substitute a high coupon and some sort of kick, either a synthetic project interest or warrants. That's a different structure around the same thing. Mm-hmm. A yield instrument that's secured in some fashion, not unsecured, that gives most of the equity participation to the common shareholder, but also gives an equity kick to the secured creditor.
Excellent. Rick, why aren't companies creating NPV flowcharts?
Why are they not? I think for most companies, they have no NPV, most junior companies. And for a company with a $60 million market cap, to say that the net present value of their assets is zero, that the only thing that you're buying is upside, telling the truth interferes with their marketing. I think with regards to the higher quality companies, there's a whole class of institutional investors over 40 years that have been trained to look for upside, not to manage downside. Mm-hmm. I think that'll change in the next 10 years. And I think you'll see a lot more net present value models as more institutional investors come to understand that value is an important component, a prerequisite to growth. Mm-hmm. What I think you've seen over the last 40 years is that the people who took the most risk in many cases got the most reward. Or at least that was a narrative. Maybe they didn't get the reward, but the narrative was that they were going to. And the consequence is that management teams have been taught to sell the upside, not to sell the present. In particular, if you construct a net present value model that's a series of matrices, the matrices include the commodity price, and they include tonnage and grade, where you don't try to arrive at one conclusion, but you try to arrive at 9 conclusions, and you look at those conclusions and build your own probability model. I think that's the correct way to do it. It's a ferocious amount of work, mm-hmm. And when people ask me why I don't follow more companies, and I tell them how much money goes into model construction for each individual company, they come to understand the constraints in models-driven net present value investing. Mm-hmm. It is a ferocious amount of work.
And that kind of goes back to your point about real quality opportunities,
right,
and kind of putting the work into analyzing those.
I was having a discussion not too long ago around a couple companies that we follow. Centaurus in Brazil, Sovereign in Malawi, and I forget the name of the rare earths one right now in Brazil. But three companies that we think have the potential to deliver absolute tier one discoveries. $10 billion in situ reserve and resource, totals, best quartile return on capital employed, best quartile, all in sustaining costs. The models construction and checking the viability of the variables in each case consumed 50 or 60 hours of my time. And probably another 50 to 100 hours in consultants' time. So each one of these junior positions, just in terms of the base case model construction, consumed 150 hours. Mm-hmm. Many small institutions don't do this because their total research budget has to do with reading press releases. They don't have either the ability or the willingness to spend 150 hours per name amortized across 50 names. If you think about 50 times 150 hours, and you think about a consultant's time at, say, $150 an hour, it's a very expensive process. There's only a few of us that have the willingness and, frankly, the resources to do it.
Mm-hmm. You know, this really falls in line with exactly what we're talking about here, Rick, is explaining your rating system. One and twos seem very rare from you. So does that mean three and four are still very good?
But let me tell you what a one is, and this will put it in context. A one is a company with what I think will become a tier one deposit, which is to say $10 billion at current commodity prices in situ recoverable reserves and resources. There are not many of these. In addition, the deposit has to be, at least in a pro forma sense, in the best quartile worldwide on return on capital employed, certainly above 25%. And it has to be in the lowest cost quartile in their commodity in all-in sustaining costs worldwide. So in the gold business, AISC probably has to be below $1,100. In addition to that, the company has to be selling at less than 50% of what I think the deposits could be sold for to an institutional buyer or an industry buyer today. There has to be a catalyst within the next 18 months, other than a takeover, that I think could and should double the share price. And there has to be the possibility that the stock could move 1,000% for feasible reasons within a 5-year time frame. That's a wonderful conjunction of circumstances. If my memory serves me well, I've had 9 or 10 number one rankings in 35 years. Of ranking stocks. Oh, and by the way, they have to need not to raise capital for the next 12 months. I forgot that one. The last number one I gave was Ivanhoe Mines in Congo. They were selling for 63 cents a share, if my memory serves me right. They had 96 cents a share cash in the treasury. In other words, they were selling at a huge discount to cash. They had recently done a private placement with an extremely intelligent investor, Zijin Mining, and CITIC, the Chinese parastatal, at $1.13. So this was selling for half the price of a new capital infusion that occurred 90 days before. I believe that they could sell the deposit to the Chinese, and this was one of three deposits, for at least double what the share price was. And the exploration success that they were enjoying at Kamoa and Kakula was off the charts. They were drilling hole after hole after hole in 5% copper in a world where the median produced grade is 0.5%. In addition to having Kamoa and Kakula, they had Kipushi, which was and is the highest grade undeveloped zinc deposit in the world. In a world where the average production grade of zinc worldwide is 5%, this is a 32% zinc deposit. And on top of that, they had the largest undeveloped platinum and palladium deposit in the world. That's what a one looks like. Hmm. There are not many.
How many years ago was that, Rick?
What year would that have been? 2016.
So it's been a while.
Yeah, 2018 maybe. It's been a long while. Mm-hmm. Mercifully for me, and I also have to know what's wrong with the stock. What was wrong with it? It was in Congo. Mm-hmm. So I had to ask myself, in Congo, there's a possibility that you could lose all your money. You put up 63 cents, you lose 63 cents. I also had to know that their cost of capital would be higher because they were in Congo. Mitigating that was that the best promoter I've ever met, Robert Friedland, was busy attempting to lower his cost of capital, which is to say raise the share price. And they had managed to attract a very, very, very intelligent group of investors at a price that was double the price the stock was selling for. Mm-hmm. So my real dilemma was, am I willing to buy something for 63 cents that could go to zero, where I think it'll go to $10? And the answer to that was yes. The juxtaposition of the upside to the downside was so substantial that I took an amount of money that I was willing to lose all of in hopes of a 10-bagger. I didn't get a 10-bagger. I got a 20-bagger. That's okay. Mm-hmm. It's the right kind of variance. There have been two other ones that I have awarded that have also been in Congo. Going way back, Kilimoto Goldfields, or Moto Gold, which ultimately was sold to Barrick, discovered what was then a 10 million ounce deposit, is now a 30 million ounce deposit. Same sort of circumstances. Because it was in Congo, it was stupidly cheap. The grades were stupidly high. The people were insanely good. And then Tanke Fungurume, the Lundin family in the 1995-1996 downturn. Stock was selling for 19 cents a share. There was 30 cents a share cash in it. It had the biggest and best undeveloped copper mine in the world, and it was controlled by the Lundin family. The value proposition was the same. People didn't have the balls to go into Congo, but you had first-class people with a first-class deposit selling at much less than half of what it was worth. What seems to be the common point around my ones is political risk. Now, in 2022, I missed a one. And I want to say this publicly. When the oil price went to zero and hovered around $20, and when ExxonMobil was kicked out of the Dow 30, all the index sellers had to sell Exxon. It was a one-off event. And the idea that the oil price could stay at 20 when the all-in cost to produce a barrel of oil worldwide, including cost of capital, was 60, was nil. Exxon would have been the best one of my career because there was no real concomitant political risk. I mean, there was political risk because some guy named Biden didn't like the oil business. And because that wonderful energy physicist, Greta Thunberg, didn't think we needed energy. But none of that particularly matters. I think it's important that people like me who trumpet their successes also describe their failures mm-hmm. from an educational point of view. And the failure to award Exxon a one, I did award it a three. The failure to award Exxon a one is something that embarrasses me to this day. Mm-hmm. By the way, it had a 13% dividend yield at that point in time.
Rick, how long would you have had to have held it to, let's say, be at a place where you would have been, looking back, happy to sell it?
I haven't sold it. It took me a year to get a double. which if you're getting a 13% dividend, shouldn't be challenging for most people. I mean, there's a whole class of speculators out there, some of whom are listening to this show, who have visions of sugar plums. You know, they read Agora newsletter copy and they believe that they're due 1,000% gain before a long weekend. But you can't trouble yourself too much for the aspirations of those people. The idea that you can get a double with virtually no downside risk with a 13% current yield, that's the greatest thing since sliced bread, irrespective of people's irrational expectations.
Well, I mean, that's one thing that I try very hard to do on this show is to be realistic and to not spread necessarily too sensational of information, because I don't think that helps this industry.
I agree with you. And it does a disservice to the people who subscribe to your channel. So you're to be congratulated for peddling reality.
Well, I do my best to, you know, traffic in the currency of reality, let's say. So on the, let's say on the subject of managing risk, that's of course the other part of this. We had a question come in that said, what does Eric do if an investment fails?
Rick or Eric?
Eric
Sprott?
I'm assuming so, yeah.
Eric has an unusually high tolerance for failure. And Eric expects a number of his names to go to zero. He has the psychological temperament and he has the financial resources that he can afford that. Eric is more afraid of missing a 10-bagger than he is losing his entire speculative capital on any one speculation. Mm-hmm. Most investors, well, almost no investors have Eric's means. You know, he's an extremely wealthy guy. A fair number of his risks have paid off. But not very many investors have Eric's temperament. I was a director of Sprott and in constant contact with him during the period 2011 to 2015, where his speculative portfolio lost between 85 and 90% of its AUM. And Eric was absolutely unbowed. There were periods of time when he was depressed, but he never stopped attempting to high grade the portfolio, you know, attempting to sell mistakes and reinvest the proceeds in the winners. Mm-hmm. And when Kirkland Lake came about and when they drilled that great hole at Fosterville, Eric was smart enough to understand that the stock exhibited better value after a triple than it had before the news. And Eric had that wonderful ability when the odds were stacked in his favor to understand the risks and go all in. Mm-hmm. Most people look at the performance of a hero like Eric Sprott and they want to emulate it, but most people don't have the psychological makeup to be heroes. And most people don't have the financial statement which would allow them to take a series of all or nothing bets.
That's a great point and something that Jonathan Murgott and I spoke about the other day as well. It's not necessarily something that you can apply in your financial situation, or not you, but you know, speaking generally.
Remember too, that people like Eric and I don't have lives. This is what we do. Mm-hmm. Assuming that gardening is important to you and reading books are important to you and your family is important to you and vacations are important to you, you need to be a bit more risk averse because you are not willing or able to do as much work as we do. Mm-hmm. Eric has access to the best research in the world, as do I. He does great research himself, and he has a staff that he pays 24/7 that does more research. Somebody who is running a small business where their own effort is directed as it should be to their own small business can't afford to try and compete with Eric and I. Mm-hmm.
Rick, is there ever a moment to go actively short the sector? And what are the signposts? How do we know when the party is over? And what would the vehicle or method be to go short?
I don't short any longer things that aren't, to me, obvious frauds. I have to believe that there is a broadly held public perception that isn't merely wrong. It's fraudulent. Mm-hmm. I don't short overvalued names where there is some value. The only thing that I short are obvious frauds. And our sector is too deeply out of favor to have any obvious frauds yet. The obvious frauds now are in small cap technology and artificial intelligence and crypto, mm-hmm. the popular sectors. There will come a time, I suspect, 5 or 6 years from now, that resembles the 1970s, where there were basically frauds under every manhole cover in Los Angeles and West LA. But we're not there yet.
Do you believe
there are people who are very successful shorting all of the high profile promotions? They are very, very, very successful, but they take a lot of risk. Remember the arithmetic around shorting. The most you can make is 100%, maybe with a fairly high degree of certainty, but the most you can lose if you're wrong is unlimited. I knew a couple people who identified BRIEX as a fraud and got shaken out. They shorted the stock at 20 on its way to 220 or 280, pardon me. You can be right. And if you don't have the courage and the conviction, you can lose a lot of money anyway.
Mm-hmm. So you wouldn't end up, let's say, shorting the entire sector as a whole once we, let's say, roll over what you would consider the peak to be.
I did that when I was younger. And I have to say that my track record with regards to contrarian shorting was unblemished by success. So I don't do that anymore. I try to have the discipline to take money out of sectors that are fairly and fully valued and put that money into sectors that are roundly hated and ignored. And I've decided that suits my temperament better. I don't like the arithmetic around shorting. Except frauds. I don't like the unlimited downside with the limited upside. I prefer the exact opposite juxtaposition of risk to reward.
Do you believe that when the economy crashes, that the stock market as a whole will take a massive hit, or some stocks to take a hit while some do well, i.e. tech stocks versus mining stocks, or a Venezuelan style situation where hyperinflation or massive inflation outweighs any potential market gains?
If I understand the question, the questioner suggests that if we have a broad spread recession, would that lead to a stock market rout? And the answer is almost certainly yes. Mm-hmm. A broad spread recession would reduce confidence in financial markets. And I would suspect call into play a liquidity squeeze of some type, perhaps not as severe as 2008, perhaps as severe as 2008. A liquidity squeeze takes no prisoners. The decision to sell isn't made by the portfolio manager. It's made by the margin clerk. And the margin clerk sells whatever has a bid. The good, the bad, and the ugly all get sold. Now, what happens is that the high-quality issuers come back first. The high-quality issuers, by the way, are not junior mining shares. The high-quality issuers come back first. So I would suspect that if we have a fairly broad-based economic recession, that we would have a credit-driven decline in both bonds and equities, and then we would have a confidence-driven decline in liquidity. And that would be ugly. I maintain large amounts of liquidity in my own event, in my own account, for just that event. I understand that deposit interest rates I'm being paid means that I'm actually losing money after real inflation by maintaining liquidity. But one of the best investment years I ever had in my life was 2009. Because I went into 2008 with both the cash and the courage that if there was a liquidity constraint, that I would benefit from it as opposed to being penalized by it. And I suspect that there is a strong possibility, if not a probability, that we will have a recession. And as a consequence of that, that we might have a liquidity event. If that occurs, I'm going to be ready. I will have the cash. And as a consequence of the lessons I've learned, I'll have the courage to push the button when everybody else is scared to death, lying in fetal position in the corner.
The button to deploy capital.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. The buy button, not the sell button.
Yeah. Rick, this question is along the same lines, but I think it captures, let's say, a lot of the sentiment around, you know, a lot of the people in this sector listening to this show. Timothy Zub asked, everyone says a whole bunch of things are on the verge of breaking. Banks, money, stock markets, cybersecurity, institutional instruments. But we have seen in the face of 3 years of imminent collapse, it is still mostly working. So when any of these things let go, does Rick think it will be in multiple steps over time or cascading all at once? I just want an idea if I will even be able to benefit from all my preparations and hedging.
The first answer is, I don't know. I'm a credit analyst, so I don't know. I can tell you this, if you are, as I am, politically libertarian, and if you are a credit analyst, you are always more cautious than the broad population. Tom, I've joked on your show before that I have correctly identified 17 of the last three share market declines. And I note that however bad things get, and I've thought that things have warranted caution since I came into the market in 1972, the ascent of humankind is the longest unbroken bull market that there is. Have we had some setbacks? Yeah. The generation before has had them too. Mm-hmm. The Great Depression, World War II, the Cold War. You know, we're not the first group of people that have faced some fairly ugly circumstances. Government gets bigger every year, which is a horrific circumstance. But thus far, Tom, we, particularly in the West, live in a culture where there is enough value for individual initiative that a young group of people can commandeer a garage in Sunnyvale and out pops Google or out pops Apple. What that means is that our individual initiative thus far has been able to fund our collective stupidity. And I suspect that 15 years from now, things will be way, way, way better than they are now. You have to get from here to there. You do that, first of all, by education, by investing in yourself, by reading, say, a book a week. You need to do it, too, by being prudent in your portfolio. You need to maintain high liquidity balances, despite the fact that that is costly. You have to own gold, precisely because gold hasn't performed yet. And you have to be a contrarian. If you and I had done an interview, a widely advertised interview in 2020 about uranium, there would have been 50,000 views because uranium was temporarily popular. If we had done the same interview in 2022, it would have been grossly unpopular. If we did an interview about uranium now that was widely interviewed, it would be popular again. In other words, the popularity would vary inversely with the utility.
Kind of like the growth of our show while gold had its run, you know, from 2020 to 21.
Correct. And what investors need to do rather than worrying too much about the direction of the world is worry much more about their own portfolio and how they organize their portfolio to make it as bulletproof as they can. And in particular, they need to remember what Buffett says, some of the things Buffett says. Buffett describes investing as a game with no called strikes. In other words, your time at bat is your money. But unlike base, if a pitcher throws one past you that you don't swing at, nothing bad happens. So it's okay to let some get away. What you do is you wait for the pitcher, which is the market, to get tired and throw you a nice fat pitch. And then you dig in your cleats and swing. Mm-hmm. Don't be afraid of missing out. Fear of missing out is where those strikes come from. Mm-hmm. Worry about the whiffs, not the ones that they throw past you. Mm-hmm. But also, when they throw a fat pitch, dig in and swing. Absolutely dig in and swing. Don't do stuff you don't understand. If you're going to do technology, get to work and learn about technology. I don't do technology, not because I don't think the technology is in the future. I don't do technology because I don't have a durable competitive advantage relative to other participants in technology. I don't know enough about it to compete in that arena. So I willingly give up the profits that could occur to my account with regards to technology if I was willing to take the risk of my own ignorance, which I am not. I am very aggressive in investing in things like insurance companies and community banks, conventional financial services businesses, and I'm very aggressive investing in natural resource businesses, particularly when they're out of favor, because I've invested my own knowledge. And so I would urge the questioner to worry a little bit less about U.S. politics, worry a little bit less about crypto, but worry a little bit less about the banking system and worry much more about one's own preparedness. I am concerned, as an example, about the continuing mismatch, duration mismatch between deposits and loans in the American banking system. But I don't, as a consequence of that, deposit money with supposedly sound too-big-to-fail banks that pay me no interest. Because of my fear, I'm going to give up 4% current yield. A much smarter response is to study banks that have good historic performance, good loan loss reserves relative to experience, and high amounts of cash on the balance sheet, which is to say, work. Mm-hmm. Don't worry. Work.
Another gem. I like that quote. Rick, as we're talking about education, you know, you have another boot camp coming up that covers a lot of these topics, right?
I do. And thank you for bringing that up. You know, in my declining years, what brings me joy is education. And I want to get paid for it. I want to build an education business like I built a financial service business. And I want that education business to survive me, like my financial services businesses will survive me. Mm-hmm. And so we do a couple things, and they're all interrelated. In the first, in Rural Investment Media, anybody who cares what I have to say can submit a stock portfolio to me, and I will grade it 1 to 10 for free. That's to get your attention. The second thing I do is I have something called the Rural Classroom. If you go to Rural Classroom, there's 200 hours of programming about how to select and how to pick natural resource stocks. And then we give you the opportunity to do it in real time. We have a live symposium in Boca Raton every year. I think it's in its 30th year this year, where we give you the opportunity to use the lessons that you learned in the Rural Classroom. We give you big picture thinkers, but we give you 50 or 60 curated exhibitors. If you're a sponsor at one of our events, it doesn't mean that you have a check that cashed. It means that we like you enough that we own you with our own money. Doesn't mean that every stock that I select goes up, but it does mean that the process is very, very, very honest. The upcoming boot camps, we do 4 boot camps a year. These are 8.5-hour online programs where we cover one topic. We did uranium when it was out of favor. We did silver, which is still out of favor. We did royalty and streaming, which are consistently good businesses. And now we're doing development and pre-development stage companies. The companies in the boring part of the Lassonde curve. You'll notice that I like what's unpopular. I like boring because I don't like being terrified. I'd prefer to be bored. And the idea is that we bring speakers who can teach you in depth about the process in understanding development stage companies. how to understand a pre-feasibility study, how to understand a feasibility study, how to understand the capital stack that goes into mine construction, how to benchmark success in the construction process, the re-rate that takes place if the company develops on time, on budget completion at nameplate capacity, which, by the way, is a consistent 12-month double. And then we introduce you to some exhibitors. The idea is that you will have prepared yourself for the boot camp by paying attention to the lessons at the Rule Classroom, which are free. We give you 8.5 hours of very dense programming, but importantly, we give you the ability to review that programming for a year, because it is impossible for anybody to absorb in 8.5 hours all the lessons that we teach. I put on the Uranium Boot Camp. I've been in the uranium business 25 years. I have now replayed the Uranium Boot Camp for my own benefit, despite the fact that I produced it 4 times. importantly, Tom, and thank you for the ability to give this commercial. Importantly, with all of my education products, the live symposium or the boot camps, if the attendees don't feel that they got their tuition worth, I'll give it back to them. No questions asked. Money back guarantee. I would prefer it if people told me where I failed, how I didn't meet their expectations, so that I can make the product better in the future. But there's no requirement. I won't hassle you to tell me why you want your money back. You just tell me you want your money back and you get it back. Now, a consequence of that, if you are a serial reneger, which is to say, if we can't service you 2 or 3 times, you'll be asked not to participate in future boot camps. Mm-hmm. So far, there's been one of those out of something like 5,000 serial attendees. But I think that's really what we're trying to accomplish, Tom.
Yeah, it makes complete sense, Rick. I want to be respectful of your time here. We still have a ton of questions to get through, from uranium to silver, manipulation, nationalization, crypto. So maybe we can do a part 2 here.
But let's do that. Let's get together and let's do that. And I'll try to pontificate less and answer more.
Absolutely. Let's do a couple, 2 or 3 more.
Great.
That are fairly quick ones. As we were on the topic of banks, ask him how his new bank, Battle Bank, is positioning itself to weather the banking crisis on the horizon. How will they survive when most others will fail?
It's important to note that Battle Bank, see my shirt, in organization, is really the continuation of a bank that we built in 1999 called EverBank. A group of us built one of the first online banks in the United States. And the first way that we outcompeted our brethren is because we didn't have any useless branches. If you aren't competent enough as a human that your computer and your phone becomes our branch, you should be somebody else's customer, not ours. That lowers our costs by about 125 or 130 basis points. The first thing is that we can deliver great service to you for less money. The second thing is that we're not going to have 15 or 16 savings products to confuse you. We're going to have one, a high-yield money market account that can be a savings account or a checking account, which we will pay you interest on. Not having a plethora of products means that our customer acquisition costs are less because we don't try to confuse you. And it means that our administrative costs around our savings programs are less because we have one, not 16. We will attempt to not do all things for all people, but we will attempt to compete where we do things better than other people. To wit, we built a very large business at EverBank, having certificates of deposits available to investors in 22 currencies rather than one. A niche product, but a niche product that became a very big business for a small bank. We will do that again. There are people who want to save and transact in numerous currencies rather than just one. This isn't a trading vehicle, it's a savings vehicle. And we won't try to be all things to all people on the lending side either. We will only participate in lending where we understand the collateral better than our competition. To wit, we're gold bugs. We grew up in the gold business. We believe gold is a good collateral. If you have large gold or silver holdings and want to access liquidity against them without selling them, either to buy more gold or silver or to use that liquidity to do something else, we will lend you money against your gold and silver or your platinum and palladium in segregated storage. Finally, we believe that your money is your money. We believe that your IRA shouldn't be a repository for our financial products. If you want your IRA to own a duplex or a triplex, which you operate, if you want your IRA to own a franchise in certain circumstances, if you want your IRA to participate in private equity, we will construct an IRA that owns an LLC that will allow you to do just that. Try that with your regular bank. See how far you get. But there's another way that we insulate ourselves. We built a bank, EverBank, with 275,000 subscribers. It's no longer our bank. But that bank no longer is servicing our customers as well as they once did. The unique products that built that bank are of less interest to TIAA CREF than they are to the depositors. So we have a 275,000 depositor base that we built before that we think we can switch. In addition to that, when we started EverBank, we had a wait list of people who had evidenced interest in depositing with us or borrowing from us of zero. At Battle Bank, the same number is about 11,000. So I think our customer acquisition cost and our focus on delivering savings and investment products to a unique niche of customers across the country is unparalleled. I describe Battle Bank as a community bank for contrarian, libertarian entrepreneurs. That's our community. Our community isn't defined by geography, but rather by ideology. It turns out being a high net worth and highly intelligent community, which is the right community to bank anyway.
Sounds like exciting stuff, Rick. Let's wrap up with one last question from my buddy Kona Capable. How likely is it that the Shanghai Exchange overtakes the COMEX for price discovery in the precious metal space in the next 5 years?
I think a zero probability. I think that we are going to develop a sort of a multilateral exchange mechanism where leadership is spread. And I think that ultimately leadership probably goes to the blockchain in commodities. I think eventually most commodities will trade on a coin-based network that's global and not controlled by dealers or not controlled by exchanges, but rather controlled by the customers. I think that's 10 years away, but I think it's inevitable. The abuses in the Shanghai system, the abuses in the COMEX, the abuses in the LBMA, I mean, understand, these are dealers' clubs. Now, I happen to have been a member of the club for a while, which was a benefit to me. But ultimately, the exchange of commodities will be controlled by the consumer 10 years from now, and it'll occur through the distributed ledger on the blockchain. And in effect, the exchange will become a cooperative.
Excellent, Rick. As I said, I want to be respectful of your time, so we'll have to set a time to do part two. If there's anybody that wants more information from you, most of your stuff is all available at Rule Investment Media, right?
Yeah, absolutely. To interact with me, go to Rule Investment Media. I will grade, rank your natural resources portfolio for free. Download your portfolio. I will rank them 1 to 10. I'll comment on individual issues where I think my comments have value. If you are interested in my bank, if you're unhappy with your current bank, in the question and comments section at Rural Investment Media, simply write bank and we'll put you on a wait list.
Perfect. Rick, thanks again so much for your time and sharing all your wisdom with us today.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me back.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.